This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off. All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Western Rookie Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today we are joined by CJ Davis. CJ, it's been a while since we've talked last. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. I appreciate you inviting me in this. Like I told you before, I love the name of the podcast. It's just an awesome concept.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Dude, it's August, right? There's guys already out doing the antelope thing. I know tons of guys who are like days away from leaving on their September opener elk hunts in a variety of different states. I know some residents of some states who are already doing the mule deer thing. Maybe some Western whitetails, like some Nebraska, I believe Nebraska has a September 1st opener for, all species for residents. And so the ball is in motion. Like everything is getting ready to get in motion. It's slow now, but we're ready to hit the gas on this hunting season.
Man, I love this time of year because my phone lights up every morning with texts from my buddies. You know, I got two of them that are dealing with bow issues right now and probably a little bit of procrastination on their part, but you know, they're getting that figured out. They're nailing down their gear list for what they're going to take. It's just an exciting time of the year. And I live down south in South Carolina, and for some crazy reason, the last two mornings, it's been unseasonably cool for us.
I know.
And so I get outside, shoot my bow a little bit in the morning. The weather's awesome. You just can't help but think about that stuff and get excited about going and doing something new, taking on a new adventure.
Yep. I'll tell you this. We are a lot like the whitetail buck, right? Or any male animal where it's just like, we peek our head out the window and it's like, ooh, it's cool. Let's go stand on the deck now. All right. Well, let's go grab our bow now. Let's make the rounds. Let's freshen up our scrapes. And
let's get off work early and go hang another tree stand.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so, yes, it was the last two mornings. It's been anywhere between 40, right around that 45 degree mark here in Iowa. And when you, like you see me wearing this sweatshirt now, the seasons are changing. And so does our attention span. It's changing from one thing to another this time of year. And dude, I'm getting ready. I'm loving it.
For sure. For sure. I'm right there with you.
All right, CJ. Before we get into the meat and potatoes of this episode, why don't you talk a little bit about where you live and what do you do for a living?
So I live in South Carolina. Ironically, I'm the president of Montana Decoy. Jerry McPherson's the original founder. He's still based out of Colstrip, Montana, a little town out there where he started the company, does all of his hunting. We make decoys for just about any kind of animal you want. We build custom decoys. So we got a little bit of everything going on, but that's my day job is, I guess you'd say running that company.
Yeah. I had a really good conversation with a guy yesterday about basically people in the hunting industry. You know, right now is what we all call buying season, right? Meaning everybody is starting to pick up their ramp up their purchases right before the season starts. It just tells you we're a bunch of procrastinators, not just your buddy. But you know, here it is, August, September are some of the biggest buying months in the year because that kind of ramps up the busyness of your company. Do you then also get busy and like, or do you still get to get out and hunt?
So for us, it's a little bit different because we're a dealer based business. So I sell to a dealer that stocks it. The consumer goes in and buys it. Mm-hmm. We're not a direct to consumer business. Although we do sell off our website, it's a very small portion of our business. So for us, it really picks up like July is really when I can see the waves start coming for orders being shipped. And, you know, those dealers will buy it in February and they pre-book it for, you know, whenever they want it to hit their store shelves. So for us right now, it's kind of tapering down. There's still some orders that are booked out. You know, you start with antelope and then you hit elk and then you hit deer. That's usually mm-hmm. kind of how it runs for us in the fall of those bigger POs and stuff. So right now it's not too terribly busy. Obviously, I work from home. I'm not the guy that has to pack up and ship out our stuff. So, you know, if CJ slips out and goes deer hunting for a couple hours in the morning, it doesn't stop the flow.
Yeah, the company's not folding at that point, right?
Yeah. It probably would if CJ was in the warehouse. So,
Love it. Yeah. Love it. Okay. So before we get into this next little portion of the podcast, I do have to let everybody know we have a new partner with the Western Rookie Podcast, and that is Wasp Broadheads. Now, if any of you guys have ever listened to me on the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, I have been shooting Wasp Broadheads. I want to say the first pack I ever bought was 2005, maybe before. So I've been shooting their heads for 20 years now. All right. And here are some really quick bullet points about why I like Wasp Broadheads. Number one, a majority of their heads are still manufactured in the United States. That to me is a big thing these days. For some reason, I'm just like back in the day, I used to be like, whatever. I don't care about that kind of stuff too much. But these days, that kind of means something to me. So that's great. Number two, the material that is used to manufacture these broadheads is second to none. It's prime grade A material. And then you just put like the design and engineering aspect on top of having really good material. It makes a killer broadhead. But that's not why I care about Wasp, CJ. Do you know why I care about Wasp broadheads?
Tell me.
Because when I make a shit shot on a deer, they destroy all the flesh, tissue, bone, whatever it is, and I get to pick that deer up even when I make a mistake. So broadheads to me are not judged on their perfect double lung heart shots. They are judged on what they do when things go wrong. And when things go wrong, it's usually not the broadhead's fault. I pulled my shot or made a bad shot, but it is the first thing that touches the animal, especially for a bow hunter, right? So
absolutely.
Huge fan of Wasp over the last 20 plus years. There was a deviation there. I think somewhere around 13 or 14, I went and tried another brand. It didn't work out. I came back to Wasp and here we are. So huge fan of Wasp broadheads. Go to wasparchery.com. Check out their mechanicals and their fixed blade options. And I do have a discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Go pick up your Wasp broadheads today. All right. There's my commercial that I had to put out. Yep. All right.
I shoot that CBW head myself. So I'm a big fan too.
Yeah.
I'm a stick bow guy, so I'm shooting cut on contact, but
Right.
Big fan.
I was thinking about picking up some of those sharpshooters. That's one of the mm-hmm. only heads that I haven't shot before. I'm usually the three blade jackhammer, or I am the, for my fixed blade options, like when I went elk hunting, was the Boss four blade.
Oh, and
yeah, Boss Four Blade. I love that head. I got to tell you a quick story about this doe I shot with a Boss Four Blade. It was right around the time where I started picking up to a heavier arrow. And I hate to say it, but I just felt sorry for this doe of what happened to her. Like, full draw, she comes broadside. She's probably at 13 yards. And I let her get by me a little bit, so she was quartering away and not completely broadside. So I stuck it right behind her front side shoulder, and it went back and hit that ball joint of the, and it knocked her straight. The arrow went through everything, knocked her straight to the ground. She, I mean, it was like it, the arrow pinned her to the ground, and then she stood up and took like 10 steps and then fell over dead. But, that right there tells me, like, if broadhead is going through all of that junk, I know it was a close shot, but still that means that it's a good head, dude. So I love Wasp.
Yeah. That Boss is kind of one of their older school heads, but man, from a durability and penetration standpoint, it's hard to beat that thing.
No, man, I'll tell you this. I don't care what year it was made. If something works, it works.
It works.
It works. Like, you don't, and I was talking to Fred, he's the Wasp guy. And Fred's just like, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel every year. We're here to make really good broadheads that kill deer. And if you like them, buy them. Right. And so, you know, like, a lot of these companies think that they need to come out with a new and improved broadhead every single year. That's not the case, dude. Find something that works for you, put it on your arrow, shoot a deer, then put another broadhead on your arrow and shoot another deer. Right. That's the way I look at it. So, yep.
I'm with you on that.
All right. We had a little pre-conversation before we started recording. You live in South Carolina, and how often are you traveling out west on these hunts? Or how often did you used to travel out west for antelope, elk, mule deer?
So, you know, like everybody, when you don't have kids, all that stuff is a whole lot easier.
Right.
And when they're little, sometimes it's easier depending on your home situation. But, you know, I try still to do two trips a year out there. You know, one of them may be a spring turkey and then a fall something. But my son is 16 now, so I'm consistently torn in missing a sports game for him. He's big into football and basketball. Mm-hmm. And going on a Western hunt because, you know, his football season has started now. And it seems like the schedule never comes out in time for me to plan around that. So invariably the dates I pick, I'm missing a game somehow. And that does irritate me, but technology is a big win. I can watch most of them on my phone as long as I get a little bit of service up there. But I try to do 2 to 3 trips a year. And he and I did a turkey trip last year. We went to Colorado and then we went to Montana. And this year I'm going to hit Montana. I've got an elk tag and a deer tag for there. And then he and I are going for antelope in October.
Oh, nice. Nice.
That'll be his first antelope hunt. I'm pretty excited about that.
You know, I'm not a huge turkey guy, but I want a Merriam fan on my wall.
They're beautiful, aren't they?
Oh my God, they're beautiful. And I want, I've seen them. I just have never been out there during the spring turkey season, but I feel like I want to make a trip out there. As soon as my kids get old enough to walk a little bit further, I feel like I want to take them out there for a spring turkey hunt. If you had to pick, what is your favorite animal out west to hunt? And you had to choose between antelope, elk, maybe mule deer. Which one are you going after?
My favorite one to just hunt, it's elk. I grew up a turkey hunter here in the South. So elk are like everybody says this, they're like a ginormous elk that you got to spend a whole lot of time packing them out. I mean, they're like a ginormous turkey. You got to spend a whole lot of time packing them out, but I dearly love antelope too. And if you had rephrased that question to what's your favorite wild game to eat, it would be hands down antelope. We literally had antelope smash burgers last night here at our house. So I just love that taste. It does have that sagey flavor. I know some people, that turns people off, but man, that's like my favorite. And antelope to me, it's the gateway drug to become a Western hunter. Cause you could still do that somewhat reasonably priced. If you wanted to do an outfitted hunt, there are still over the counter tags and, you know, that whole tag situation is ever evolving. And, you know, we can trade stories on how many points it takes to draw a tag that you used to could get with 1 year's points, or it used to be over the counter. Now you got to draw it. All that stuff is, it's always in flux and it's changing. But, you know, you can do an early antelope season in August when nothing else is going on. You're typically hunting over water holes. It's a lot, it's a lot hotter. And I killed my first one, I think, it was in Montana, and it was on my birthday, which is August 16th. So that's been a long time ago, but that was just a really cool experience in a different terrain. And then you go back out there in September and catch them in the rut. And that's, you know, where our decoys really come into play for us. A lot of guys use them during that, because those antelope are, you know, they're, I'm not going to say they're territorial, but they're protective of a harem of does and stuff. They're just a, such a unique American animal too. Like, you know, a deer skull from a muley or a whitetail kind of looks similar. And, you know, an elk kind of looks similar. It's just a much bigger scale, but an antelope's just, it's just a unique animal. I love
them. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I, that's one thing that I have never done, is use a decoy in any type of mule deer, elk, or antelope situation. It, but it sounds like that's something that you use a lot.
I do. And obviously I run a decoy company, so you take everything I say with a grain of salt. But yeah, I think antelope are, if you ask me what animal do I think my success rate is best on with decoys, I'm probably going to tell you, I feel like elk react to them more often than anything. Turkey's a close second. We don't make waterfowl decoys, so we're not really in that at the moment. But those two animals just really resonate for using a decoy. And it's a mobile type of hunting a lot of times. You can do the blind thing for antelope with, like, you know, put a doe or two around a water hole, kind of confidence decoys, if you will. But I do love hunting those two with them. And, you know, the ideal scenario is you've got somebody with a decoy and a call off behind you, and you're calling through just like you would with turkeys or whatever.
Right. All right. So I want to go back to this antelope, right? We have passed the season opener, obviously, of most of the antelope states. Usually a lot of them start up in August, and then we come into the rut here. What type of weapon, what type of season do you typically go to, like, go buy tags for when you're antelope hunting?
So there are places, you know, that you can get rifle tags for them. They're a little bit harder to get. And the hunt I mentioned that my son and I are doing, we're doing it in Colorado, and it's in October, and it's a rifle hunt. Okay. Typically September, the bulk of that's going to be archery hunts for those. So, you know, you're spotting and stalking. If you got a buck that's running with, you know, a harem or a herd of does out there, and you can get terrain in your favor to get within a couple hundred to 100 yards of him and pop a decoy up, you got a really good chance of him wanting to push that intruder out. And it's a, you know, it's an interesting, if you've never done that, it's very, it's like the, you know, if you're reaping turkeys with a fan or something like that, and you got those turkeys and they just commit and they just charge, and you're kind of caught off guard because you're not used to that. And that's the same thing with antelope. I mean, I've had them charge, and I get my freaking broadhead hung into a bunch of sage because I'm not paying attention. And, you know, you could just, it can really rattle you to where you can screw that up royally. But they're not a really big animal. I'm guessing a little bit, but maybe 115, 110 pounds for a buck, you know? So from an archery standpoint, they're not like built of muscle and bone like an elk or something like that is. So it's a great animal to bow hunt. It's typically open country where you're chasing those things around, so you have a good visual on where they run, where they go.
Yeah. So from an archery standpoint, right? Mm-hmm. I love my uncle told me, he read an article, and the writer of this article, this was several years ago, said that antelope are stupid. Okay. They're dumb. They're dumb animals. And so I think this is just luck how it broke down. So he's like, I'll make my own decoy out of a refrigerator box, and I'll take a black magic marker. I'll cut out the silhouette, and then I'll just create the horns on it, and I'll create this patch on it, and maybe throw a little white paint on it. And he did the challenge call, which, by the way, I've always said that the antelope challenge call sounds like some guy blowing a kazoo. At like kazoo, if anybody knows what that sounds like. And an antelope charged him, and he shot it with his bow. And I'm just like, you gotta be kidding me. That's how easy it is. And then I have other friends that, you know, they've gone out and struck out a lot doing that. What are some
tips? There's some regulations, like in some states you can't flag for antelope, which is like taking a white piece of cloth and waving it. People used to do that a lot. And that's actually regulations against, there are actually regulations against that in some states. Don't ask me which states. I just remember reading about that.
But, I read an article about that too.
That's interesting to me because I'm not sure what waving a white cloth at an antelope makes them think. I get seeing a decoy, and maybe you said it was your uncle. Maybe your uncle cardboard decoy looks so horrible that any buck's going to come try to run it over or something. I don't know. Whatever it is, it worked for him, right?
It did.
I would have rather him buy one of mine so I can go antelope hunting more often, but I get it.
Yeah, exactly. So talk to me a little bit about the decoying process of an antelope. Like you see, you do some glassing. Now it's time to get closer to them. What are the steps to get closer with a decoy and pull off an archery shot?
First thing, you got to read the terrain and determine, you know, how can I close this distance? Let's say you glassed him from 1,000 yards. I mean, popping the decoy up then, you're just not in that bubble to consistently get results from that. The closer you can get to him to pop that decoy up, you know, and when I say pop it up, I mean showing it to him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I like to be certainly within 200. Ideally, I'm right around that 100-yard marker. So if you're in some rolling terrain, you know, use that, maybe top a hill, you can do stuff with an antelope decoy that you probably wouldn't want to be doing with other species, you know, topping a hill and showing it, getting skylined. They can't count legs, so you're using the decoy to cover you. You know, ideally, you have a buddy with you that's running the decoy, and you're the guy that's in charge of just keeping up with your bow and drawing and making the shot, maybe ranging, whatever you got going on there. So use that terrain. It can be a wash. It can be a hill, it can be rock outcropping, whatever you can do to move to get them blocked from you to get to that closing distance. And then I don't like pop it up. You just ease it up. And Jerry, our founder, he's really good at this. He hunts antelope every year there in Montana. And he always has great stories of, you know, you'll pop it up and it's like, oh man, nothing's going to happen. You look away, you look back and you're like, where'd the buck go? He disappeared. I could see that. And all of a sudden there he is. He charged. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of, you're always on this state of ready once you get to that point where you're showing the decoy. And again, antelope aren't, you know, they're not huge animals. So, you know, you're talking about shooting that 3-blade jackhammer. You'll smoke right through them with that thing for sure. So, you know, you can get away with a little bit more with shot placement, I think. Not that you would want to take an unethical shot, but they're not as big and burly as some stuff.
Yeah, I heard, and I also heard that once shot, they give up early. Like they're a weaker animal. They don't try to fight like a whitetail does and like haul ass. Even if they're wounded, they tend to just give up and quit and go lay down. Is that true?
You know, I have one story of it was kind of late in the rut. And we were slipping around and we found this buck by himself. You know, he wasn't a dominant with a big harem of does or anything. And he was just kind of feeding across and we were able to get down in this draw and come up. And I was still shooting a compound back then. And I thought I was a pretty good shot. And I remember we, you know, we're peeking through the sage to find him. And then we get the decoy and we raise the decoy and I come up with the decoy, you know, and draw. And I'm not trying to get him to come to the decoy. That was to get him to stay there just long enough for me to make a shot, which is another way to use those things. And I picked out a spot on his hide and I just went into, that's where I'm shooting. I ranged him, took the shot. I was so focused on that. I didn't realize he had turned a little bit. So what was going to be a great shot at the point when I picked it, he turned towards me and it became a gut shot at that point. Mm-hmm. And he didn't go very far. He just went a couple hundred yards and, you know, I'm watching him and I'm waiting on him to tip over and he stops, he hunches up. Everybody knows what that means, right? Yep. And then he beds down, but he didn't go that far and it's all wide open. And we were able to slip back up on him. And if I'm being honest, I didn't feel like we should have been able to slip back up on him that easily. So I kind of get in that instance what you're saying, like, you know, maybe he just kind of gave up a little bit where I do not feel like I could have crept up on a whitetail in that same scenario. I feel like I would have blown a whitetail out. Put another arrow in him, you know, all's well that ends well, I guess. But The irony is I hit exactly where I wanted to hit, but I just wasn't paying enough attention to the orientation. Like he went from quartering away to quartering two, and my brain didn't compute that. So,
yeah.
Your little one grew 3 inches overnight. Adorable. Also, expensive. Sell their pint-sized pieces on Depop and list them in minutes with no selling fees. Because somewhere, a dad refuses to pay full price for the clothes his kids will outgrow tomorrow. And he's ready to buy your son's entire wardrobe right now. Consider your future growth spurt budget secured. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
Yeah, I've been on some mule deer hunts, and I was going after mule deer. I've been on one antelope hunt in Nebraska. And when I was out there trying to bow hunt, I didn't have a decoy. And so I was having to use every little nook and cranny of terrain to try to get close to these animals. Mm-hmm. With that said, are there instances where you will glass up an antelope and then look at the surrounding terrain and just be like, dude, I do not have an opportunity here?
Yeah, and I think in that situation, you have to, maybe approach it as a sit back and wait and see where that herd goes. You know, if they're going this way, I've got options over here. If they stay where they are, I've got no options unless I really just want to try to walk up on them with a decoy from 1,000 yards away. And your odds of that are a little bit less. Now, if there's cattle out there, you might could try one of our moo cow decoys, Big Red or Bessie, and use that, to get close to them because they're familiar with those. And you might get in bow range like that, or you have that antelope decoy with you and you work it out from behind there. So there's some options to that, but the better scenario is there's some breaks in the terrain that you can move to. I did a hunt in Montana. This again has been years ago, and it was awesome. This was when I worked for a public relations agency, so somebody else was paying for all these. But we would elk hunt in the morning, and there was another pasture, they called it, that had an antelope in it that I would go chase around in the middle of the day with my stick bow. And then in the afternoon, we'd hunt alfalfa for mule deer. The only thing I left that hunt with was a mule deer, but man, I had a blast in the middle of the day going out there and chasing that out. I felt like that guy that has a pocket full of tags, and it doesn't matter if this doesn't work out because I'm going to chase mule deer. Or now that didn't work out, I'll be back on elk in the morning. It's just a great trip. Yeah. But I never did get within range of that antelope. And man, I was every day it was felt just like that old cartoon with the coyote and the sheepdog. That's exactly what I felt like every day. I was like, okay, there he is. And I think he went, oh, yeah, there's that dummy again. So we just kept playing a very long game of tag that never changed.
Never went anywhere.
No, it was awesome, though.
Yeah. So you glass up these animals at about 1,000 yards, these antelope at 1,000 yards, and you say, okay, it's pointless to put it up now. Let's go try to find some terrain to hide behind. And then you mentioned this bubble that they have, and you're trying to get inside this bubble. From your experience, what is that from a yardage standpoint? What is that bubble when you're trying to slowly present that antelope decoy to that antelope?
So that bubble to me is really strong, close, and it fades. And I would say the sweet spot I want to get is 100, 125 yards. I feel like if I get inside or to that and I show that buck a decoy, if he is in the right mindset and I've done everything that I should do to get to that point without alerting them in any way, that's where I feel like my best odds are.
Okay.
You get, I guess there's a scenario where you could get too close and suddenly you pop out right on them. Mm-hmm. That's probably not a great scenario either, but I don't typically have that problem. My problem is getting close enough, not getting too close.
Yeah. Okay.
And that bubble, I put that bubble on everything I hunt. You know, if I'm in a woodlot and I'm grunting at a whitetail, I feel like if I'm within this bubble, he's more likely to respond than if he's 300 yards away across the field or I'm rattling at him or whatever.
Right.
And turkeys especially.
Right. How often so what's the breakdown, would you say, of you present that decoy to that antelope and he tries to push his harem away versus you present the challenge call or he comes in and he tries to just knock you out?
Just going on my own personal experience with that, and we'll delete the hunts that I messed up and may have alerted them on earlier in the day to get to them. But if they're, if they don't know they're being hunted on that day, I feel like you gotta, and it's the right time of the year and you've seen him chasing some other bucks off. That's just like, that's one of the telltale signs of this is going to work is if you've seen him run other bucks off. If I, if I've got that, I haven't spooked them. I don't think there's anybody else that's messed with them and I could get within that 100 yards. Golly, I am overconfident at that point. I'll probably tell you 70, 75% chance he's coming in. And man, those are odds I walk 5 miles for every day of the week. So,
All right. I like that.
Nothing's ever locked down for sure, or else we wouldn't be doing this. It would take the fun out of it. But I feel that confident. Now, okay, let's say I bumped the crap out of him three times the day before, or I haven't seen him engage with any other bucks. You know, it's always a sliding scale there a little bit, but
yeah, you just have
it's one of the more effective animals to decoy.
Yeah. So you have more indicators that lead to you that build your confidence saying, okay, he's already defending this animal. I come in, he's going to do the same thing he did to these other ones.
Yeah. And he may even think I'm one of those bucks he ran off earlier. I don't know.
Right.
I don't like giving animals, what's that term? Anthropomorphism. Is that right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, animal morphism.
I don't like doing that to animals, so I tend to shy away from that. I don't know what he's thinking. I just base it off of experience of how they react and what I see him doing naturally out there. And, you know, there's times he's running around chasing bucks off, and you can't predict where he's going. So, you start up this draw, and crap, he's 300 yards over there. And you know how fast those things are. So, like, you're making the stalk, and you get to where you want to be, and he's 700 yards that way because some other little buck popped up and he ran him off. Yep. He'll come back if the does stay there, but they may drift off. So there's a lot of, it's just a great chess match.
Right. When it comes to archery, what do you, and let's say if I told you, hey, CJ, I'm going out to Wyoming. I'm going to try maybe using a decoy. I'm going to try shooting an antelope with a bow. Give me your best idea of range. What should I be prepared to shoot?
So, I mean, you know, I think that's ability is a little bit easier to nail down because, you know, I've been shooting all summer. I know I'm great out to 75 yards. I can put every single arrow in a softball. Mm-hmm. And then you have to gauge how does the animal react. And even with a super fast compound, there's always some reaction time. But I think consistently, antelope, open terrain, it just lends itself to a little more accurate, a little more long range shooting. I wouldn't have a problem with somebody that's competent and you know, can control their nerves, you know, 60, 70 yards on an antelope. Yeah. They don't typically jump the string. Nothing jumps the string like a whitetail, right? I don't think of anything that, you know, elk will stand there and watch you shoot them sometimes and never flinch, but rarely do I have a whitetail that doesn't react at some way to a bow. It doesn't matter how close or how far they are. So if you put a whitetail in that situation, I would bring that yardage in, but it's an antelope, you know, great shooter. But if you can't shoot but 40 or 50 yards confidently, then, you know, I would not go antelope hunting. A lot of them get shot practically point blank range, especially over a water hole. You know your yardage if you're hunting them early season. But
yeah,
it's definitely a more capable animal for long range shooting.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about when to bail on a hunt. Because there's times where you get in there and you're like, I'm going to push it. And then you bump the antelope, maybe with a decoy, maybe not. Break it down on what happens when maybe you are busted, or if you push it, you're going to ruin it for maybe even the next day.
So I don't worry about the next day so much. It does factor in, but if I bumped him today, I would still come back to hunt him. Like that earlier example I was giving you of chasing that antelope in Montana, like it was him. That was the only antelope that was in that pasture. And he and I were hanging out every single day. I found him every single day.
Yeah.
I didn't kill him, so maybe I should have left. I don't know. But I didn't have any other options either. So that's the big thing to me, or what are my other options? Yeah. If I've scouted, I got a ton of terrain, I know there's a lot of antelope, I bump this one, or they're out in the middle of wide open, too flat, I can't get close enough, I'll bail. I'll go somewhere else. It's kind of like looking for the goblin turkey. But if you're in a situation where that's the only game you got in town, it is not like whitetails to me. You know, you bump a buck in your core area that you've been hunting him, you know, you kind of expect to not have any action there for a while. But with antelope, you know, I feel like I go right back the next day, or, you know, if that happened in the morning later that day, and you can at least still find them and make a decision, where you don't have that luxury with a whitetail or elk or stuff.
Right.
It's wide open country. They rely on their eyes. I think they develop a, as long as it's that far away, I'm not too worried about it. You know, they'll bump, they'll shy off, all that kind of stuff. It probably gets worse in gun season. But it's not quite the same to me. I'll over harass an antelope compared to anything else, I guess.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. And is a lot of that also because there's so many of them in certain circumstances out there that if you blow something up, you can just go to the next herd, the next buck down the road?
It's some of that, because you can find them easier. It's open terrain. But it's also part of whatever their makeup is, that, you know, I'm okay chasing spooked antelope. Now, the one thing I would say, if it's a water hole situation and you booger up a water hole you're sitting on, then they may divert from that water hole for a while.
Yeah.
But we're talking decoy and spot and stalk in the rut. It's a little bit different to me. I'm okay attempting and then coming back up, or the next day even.
Right. Okay, cool. What about this? Do all the same things kind of come into play during the rifle season? Or is that like, it's a rifle, dude, I can shoot them at 500 yards.
Yeah, I think that goes directly to how far of a competent rifle person you are. If you can, you know, shoot that far.
Yeah.
We do rifle hunts where we do use decoys, again, for that same reason of holding that antelope. You know, I don't want to shoot at a running antelope if he's 50 yards or 500. I want to shoot at a standing antelope. So obviously there's some, you know, if you're on public ground with a safety concern, I feel obligated to say that with a rifle. But yeah, it's definitely, I think your biggest hurdle is getting the tag and getting the access at that point. If you're doing it with an outfitter or something like that, it's not as, your odds are way higher. I guess that's what I'll say.
I got you. All right. Fair enough. Okay. Overall, now, how you mentioned that antelope is like the gateway drug for a Western hunter. Elaborate a little before we transfer over to elk. Elaborate why someone should maybe try an antelope hunt before they start investing into a bigger elk hunt.
I think it's I'm not a very patient person. Right. And when I want to do something, I want to do it. And so, okay, man, I'm going to have to save up for 3 years to do this elk hunt, but boy, I could probably squeak out an antelope hunt this year. That's my fault. That's my effort on it, but it is more cost effective. It gets you out west in some beautiful country that, you know, you may never have seen before, certainly never hunted in if it's your first time.
Yep.
And it's just an amazing difference for somebody that's, you know, especially east of the Mississippi, you know, the way the terrain looks, how open it is. You know, you find yourself, you got to work on your yardage estimating. So you're running around with your rangefinder all the time, making sure if you have to guess it. It's just a price point. It's an accessibility from a from a archery tag standpoint. And, you know, if you're not in the greatest shape in the world, you could do an early season hunt, and, you know, you're doing it over a water hole in a ground blind or something like that. So it's not typically as physical as an elk hunt is. So there's another advantage for it. And, you know, there is absolutely no reason that everything you use whitetail hunting won't translate to shooting an antelope. You know, you're sitting in a blind, you can take your quiver off, you can do whatever you like to do in a tree stand, you're just doing it in a ground blind. You do need to keep an eye out for rattlesnakes a lot more often than you do in a deer stand, though.
That's a fact.
They do love to crawl into those blinds.
That's a fact. This was this would have been one of my first 2 or 3 years to South Dakota, and I had a hammer of a rattlesnake slide across, not on top of my boot, but I'm talking like 2 feet in front of me.
Ugh.
And I froze. Right. And I mean, he was baseball bat thick.
Oof.
giant, big head on them. And then I saw them squeak down into this crack, and I'm like, I'm going to change my glassing location real quick.
So, suddenly 100 yards over there looks
exactly,
a lot better.
Exactly.
And, the other thing I should have mentioned too is, like, I mean, you go into all your buddies' houses, you go into whoever you know, and you look at all these great deer mounts, and there's some turkey fans, and some people might have an elk. But how often do you see a mounted antelope in somebody's house? It's that unique. It's so cool. Their hide is so different. Those hollow hair fibers, the way they're built to do what they do, and the eye sockets on a European mount of one. They're just such a cool looking animal when you bring them back home. And again, for me, that meat is so good.
Yep.
So good.
Yep. Absolutely. I will say this. I have had antelope backstrap before, and it was one of the favorite wild game meats that I've ever tasted. Better than elk, better than whitetail. Although I will say, I shot a Kansas whitetail this year, and that Kansas whitetail was absolutely delicious. I mean, better than my Midwest or my Iowa whitetail. The meat off that was sweeter for some reason. It wasn't as corny, acornish. Some reason, it had a different taste to it, and it was really damn good. And I've had antelope, and antelope is sweeter. It's got that sage, hint of sage on it. Man.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
I'll get run out of South Carolina for saying this, but these deer that we call pine goats that live off briars and rocks.
Yeah,
man, they're just not as good as what you guys have. And I don't care if it's Iowa, Wisconsin, Kansas, whatever. Yeah. You just got more fat on the meat. There's a difference.
There is a difference. All right. Now we're hard pivoting towards elk. All right. What do you love about elk hunting?
The interaction. They're again, everybody says this, but they're like a turkey in that regard, that, you know, you could talk to them, and it's like, you know, that turkey gobble when you hear it in the morning. It's just that elk bugle when you first hear that, and you know he's somewhere you can get to, and you're in the game, so to speak, and then you're in this beautiful country doing it too.
Yeah.
It's just that back and forth interaction, and then they're such a great animal for a bow hunter too. Like, I love bow hunting turkeys, but nothing changes the way it presents its vitals to you like a turkey. Is he standing there? Is he strutting? You know, is his fan to you, but his body's turned? There's all these little angles you got to think about. But an elk is this big, huge slab of meat that if I can get within 20 yards, I feel like I've got this. You know, I'm going to make this shot. I can read his body language. Just an impressive set of antlers. Even a small bull is a huge animal. So,
yeah.
There's just a lot of things to love about them, and the way they go crazy in the rut sometimes, and you'll have these experiences where there are all these bugling elk and these cows running around, and you get back at camp at night and it's amazing, but you're perplexed because I had all these elk around me and I never even got a shot off. How did that happen? You know, it's just so much going on. And then there's days you spend just trying to hear a bugle sometimes. So it's the highs and lows for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like the representation, or the comparison, I should say, to turkey hunting is pretty spot on, right? Some days they're loud and crazy, and other days just dust.
Where'd
in
they
the
go?
Wind.
It's like they left.
Yeah, they left.
I think elk hunting too, like if your mindset, if you've got that determination and that discipline to keep after it, I think that serves you the best in the elk woods mm-hmm. as much as it does anywhere else, for sure. Because it's right. it's easy to get, especially a guy like me that lives at maybe 50 feet of elevation going out there. It's easy to get run down when you mm-hmm. get tired. Your body aches, and then your mind starts wandering, and you lose your focus on that. But if you can just keep that focus and keep making yourself go up that next hill every day, that pays dividends in the elk woods. Doing it smart, of course, you know, right. not just bundling through bedding areas and stuff. But
right. What kind of terrain do you typically hunt your elk in?
So that's a great question. My favorite place in the world to go elk hunting is the Bighorns in Wyoming. I love that mountain range. I love the way it looks. I love where it sits. There's a great little, not little, but there's like a lodge that sits up there. There's a couple of them, but there's a bear lodge up there, and they have like, little cabins and stuff you can rent and kind of base camp out of that. Has a restaurant in there. You can kind of pick up supplies and stuff there. There's some trout streams around. I love to fly fish too. It's just a lot going on, but could draw that tag with like 1.5 points and, you know, now it's 11 or something. So the feasibility of going in there, you can hit some of those units on a general tag at the later part of September, but you're dealing with a lot more people in them too.
Yeah.
But that was a perfect combination to me. Montana, where I'm going this year, that's a beautiful part. Some of the places I've hunted in Colorado remind me of a briar thicket in South Carolina where they've been burned and then they've grown up with that devil's club and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nasty getting through, but those elk there have adapted to it. They live in it, but man, it just rips your clothes, knocks your arrows out of your quiver. You're just fighting it the whole time. It's not that when you lay down at night and you think about hearing a bugling bull and seeing him charging across this aspen meadow with all the colors, that's not the place.
That's not real life.
That's not real life right there. Yeah, but there's elk there, so, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. The Primos videos are a lot different than the real world videos or the real world hunts that I've been on. Here's what blows my mind about elk. We hunted Colorado. Our base camp was at 10,000. Okay. Mm. Then most days we would just go up from there, right? And so this mid-September, they're anywhere between 10 to 11.5 in elevation, Colorado. And here we are just hiking up 3-stack deadfall almost the entire hunt. And we're making noise and we're just like, oh my God, this sucks. Pull out a bugling, you know, we do a bugle. And there's nothing, right? And then you look behind you. This happened to me. We're set up on this meadow, and this elk had come in from behind us through all of that deadfall that we without making a single noise. So they're 800 pounds. I'm 220 pounds, and they just tiptoed through that without making a sound. And I
didn't even hit an antler on a limb.
It didn't seem like it, right? And so I'm focused on this meadow. 40 yards behind me, I look, and there's this bull just standing right behind me. He sees me move, and he takes off. And that's the only time I heard him was when he was running away from me. So I'm just like, and then you're just physically defeated after days and days of going over up and down all that stuff at that altitude. And then, you know, for me, I'm just like, screw this. I'm taking a morning off and then I'll go out. I'll go the next morning. But the range in which they live, everything from down into these pivot fields along creeks and stuff like that, all the way up to 11,000 feet. That just really captivates me that these animals are able to live in such a huge range. Same with mule deer.
Man, you cracked that 10,000 foot barrier too. You know it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know it. Every step hurts.
Yeah.
But especially, right.
I was going to say,
it's
especially
amazing how they can walk through that stuff and, you know, it's like they float over it or something.
Exactly. I don't know. So talk to me about this strategy and then implement your usage of decoys into trying to get close to an elk with a bow.
It's a lot like whitetails to me because, you know, you're locating them first. Whitetails, you're doing it visually typically, where with elk, you're locating them you know, with your ears. Hopefully they're bugling. That's what we want to have. And then, you know, you kind of read the terrain. You're always thinking about thermals and, you know, you're always in this mind battle with yourself of, okay, the sun's not up yet, but once it hits this, the thermals right. are going to switch. When's that going to be? How long do I have? Can I skirt this way to gain some ground? All those things come into play. But I want to, again, you know, get inside his bubble to call to him if I can. I may bugle to locate a bull, all that stuff, but I really want to get, you know, that, again, that 100-yard barrier, I guess, is where I ideally want to be set up when I'm ready to call. And then, right. you know, checking the wind. And if I'm hunting by myself, you know, I'll put the decoy slightly off to the side and behind me and, you know, try to guess where he's going to come through. You know, in a better scenario is I have you back there running the decoy and you're calling yep. and you don't have an elk tag, so you're not worried about shooting. It's all on me.
Right.
But it's just putting that decoy somewhere that is visible and you can get an angle on them, so to speak. Talking about that rough place in Colorado, I killed a bull there several years ago. And, you know, I took off one morning, heard some bugling. It died down. I'm slogging through all this stuff. I hit this little ridge and I get up on the very edge of it. There's this rock. And I'm sitting there, you know, trying to decide what am I going to do at this point. It's late morning. I could go back to camp. I could catch a nap. I could get some good food. Just sitting on this rock, got my pack off and my bow laying there, kind of in that little bit of a dejected hunter mind phase. And it dawns on me that the wind's not blowing, but about 150 yards away, I could see this aspen tree doing like this.
Mm.
And it took my slow brain like, oh, wait a minute, that's got to be an elk, right? And so I start glassing and I finally pick out a little bit of an antler up there. So I know what I'm dealing with. And the wind is kind of cutting this way. So I shift a little bit. And there's a lot of that devil's club, but there's like, it's not man-made lanes, but there are those natural openings that come mm-hmm. through it. And I set the decoy over here, kind of beside me, thinking he's going to pop out this way and see it, and that'll be his focus. But instead, what pops out is a spike, which they're not legal there at mm-hmm. this point in time. But that decoy saved me because it kept that spike from spooking. Like he came forward, locked on the decoy, and, you know, I'm squatting on the ground here, and the bull that I want to shoot starts coming, but he takes a different angle. He can't see the decoy, so he's not coming to the decoy. He's coming to my calling, but I've got this spike right here staring at the decoy, and then he sees me move, so he's staring at me, then back to the decoy, and I'm confident the decoy held him there, and that bull walked right there, and I got a 15-yard shot on him. He turns around, runs back the way he came. I actually see him roll over, so it was a great hunt. But the bull I wanted never saw the decoy, but I felt like it held that spike there because if he would have blown and ran back through there, I'm confident that would have ended my day for it. But my scenario is always off of the decoy by myself. You know, sometimes you get caught and you're trying to use the decoy to make them think the movement they saw was another elk instead of yourself, and you're mm-hmm. trying to get around and shoot on it. And there's nothing wrong with that, but if I've got the time and the setup lends itself, I want the decoy slightly behind me. You know, and I'm calling to it. And if they're committed and coming, just like when you got a turkey coming to you, stop calling, you can only mess this up. So, and if they lock on that decoy and they keep coming to it, I don't want to make another sound except when I jump the string.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man. I feel like there's been times, and I have not used a decoy very much in my life, right? I'm all about, like, I'm more of a position guy, but it sounds to me like that was a perfect example of a decoy saving you from another animal getting downwind to you.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to say I planned that at all. That was just
right. Fortunate it just happened that way for that exact scenario. Something stood up, took a look at it. Meanwhile, the other deer's coming at it, or the other elk's coming at a different angle. If that decoy wasn't there, that elk would have moved behind you and would have caught you.
Yeah.
Good deal. Worked out great, right?
And those decoys are handy for other things too. Like I have hid under them in a rainstorm. I'll lay them out on the ground to take my nap on. And if you forget the floor for your tent, you can put those down under your tent too. So
there's
a lot of good things.
Multi-use.
Yeah.
How do you navigate decoying elk in thicker timber?
So, you know, there are times when I don't put a decoy out, whether it's whitetails, elk, or whatever. If I feel like if that elk's going to pop out in range and it's going to be super close to the decoy, I don't like them rounding a cedar tree and spotting the decoy. I want them to see the decoy before that, because I feel like that could just cause an alert. I didn't know that elk was there. I didn't hear it. I didn't smell it. Just causes a little anxiety there on their part. And right. if I'm hunting a saddle or a water hole or something like that, depending on the terrain, if it's in a very open area, I might put decoys out. But if it's some wallow tucked up in the middle of a devil's club thicket, I might just try to be low impact, never see them. But it's reading the terrain. It's looking for the lanes. You know, if it's so thick that they're going to jump on, be on that decoy before they know it, I might not have a whole lot of shooting opportunity. So I need to find somewhere that I'm confident I can shoot.
Yeah.
So I kind of base my decision on, you know, every now and then you're about the top of a ridge and a bull bugles right on top of it and you're just caught. It's just like a turkey gobbling. But I try to plan. I need some shooting lanes. In my shooting lanes, I'm shooting a recurve. We're not talking very long here. 20 yards right. would be great for me. So I just try to read that terrain, always keeping the wind in mind, because you can't beat their nose. So you've always got to be thinking about thermals and wind direction when you're up there, and set up based on natural travel corridors that you see in that terrain, where they're going to see that decoy. And that decoy's job is to bring them in, but it's just as important that decoy's job takes their focus. Yeah. So they're drilled on that, and a little bow limb movement or me twisting just enough to get a shot, they just ignore that. That's my goal.
Gotcha.
Okay. It's a lot of reading the terrain. And a whitetail hunter, I think, you know, you get good at picking out pinch points, you know, edge terrain, stuff like that. All that applies to elk hunting. You know, you got to use your whole brain with that stuff, and, you know, your turkey calling experience, you know, you got to use that experience to tie in with elk. And right. all that comes together. And that terrain does look different, and they do use it a little bit differently than a whitetail uses a white oak woodlot in South Carolina. But you right. you kind of learn to see the seams, you know what I mean?
Yep, 100%. Now, what is the ideal, right? That obviously decoying elk in thick, dark timber isn't ideal. What is the ideal decoy setup for you for elk? Let me add a little bit more to this. You bugle, you get a response, you bugle again, he's closer. Now tell me what the ideal setup is.
So check the wind. I'm good on the wind. I call again. He bugles at me. I cow call to him. He bugles at me. I'm putting that decoy right where that last cow call came from. And I planned this out. I picked the tree I want to back into, or the rock I want to get behind, whatever. And I'm calling from that decoy. If he's a very vocal bull, you can track him. So I'm not as risky as if I didn't hear anything, but I want to call from that decoy and then get to my cover. So he is heard, and they're just like whitetails, just like turkeys, man. They can pinpoint where that noise is coming from amazingly well. And so they're coming straight locked on that. And then he sees the decoy, and it's just, he's never even, there's nothing that makes him look over here. If I do my job, if I don't step on a stick, my arrow doesn't fall off my bow, whatever. Everything is telling him there's an elk. I see it. I hear it. I can't smell it. He knows which way the wind's blowing. It's better than I do. So it's just an ideal scenario to call from the decoy and move. Now, if you're with me, you're staying with the decoy and calling anyway, but I like hunting by myself a lot, and I seem to end up that way. Maybe I'm not a very good campmate. I don't know, but I end up hunting by myself a lot. So doing that little trick has helped me out a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes they don't come the way you think. They'll circle. They'll do whatever. I had a bull in the Bighorns in Wyoming. It was the year we got Montana. We bought the company from the founder. And man, I was just, you know, I'd never seen the place other than on a map. We get out there tromping around. It's not that bad of terrain as far as up and down and cuts. And I hear this bull bugle, and he ends up being out in this huge sage flat. There's like just this little finger of timber that he's kind of out around. I can glass him. I see him. There's no way I can get to that spot of timber. It kind of rolls down to him in a bowl, mm-hmm. and the wind is doing this. And so I bugle at him, and he responds. He sounds interested. He bugles again on his own, and I set my decoy up here. And again, it's all sage, so it's not like I got a ton of cover. I set my decoy up here. I call from it, and then I drop, which to my mind is perfect. I'm out of his main line of sight once he recognizes the decoy, and the wind is blowing from him to me. It's blowing away from him for the decoy, so he can't smell me, he can't smell the decoy, and he just walks straight up there to it. And I mean, he is 4 feet from it. Mm-hmm. Man, I draw back and I send the prettiest arrow you've ever seen about an inch under his friggin' heart, never touching. And he hops off, and then he sees me at that point, and he kind of locks in on me, and I'm not comfortable taking a frontal shot with my stick bow. And we have this staring game of him to the decoy to me, to the decoy to me, to the decoy to me, and he finally turns and runs off after a while. But that scenario, wide open country, you know, the sage covered me from about my thigh down, but I'm crouched down. So the top half of me is up, but because that decoy just got his attention based on the noises, the sounds, the calls he'd heard, it's an ideal scenario right up until the point I shot.
Right. Right. So the goal is get them coming straight line to the decoy, and then you're off to try to get a broadside shot as they're making that.
Yeah. And if you're perpendicular, compound, you got a little more range. Typically, you know, you got a little wider margin of error there. Something that I might not be able to shoot at, a compound guy would still be pretty much in the wheelhouse if those lanes exist. And, you know, you've been out there, you get a lot of dead limbs on those pines and stuff and those aspen limbs. You know, it's not as wide open as it seems a lot of times when you get in the timber.
Right. What happens when that elk gets hung up? Like, how are you repositioning? So we'll take that same scenario. You bugle, he bugles. You cow call, he bugles. You set it up. He presents himself. You can see him from where you're at, but he doesn't come into the decoy. How are you then repositioning to try to get a move, make a move on him after 10 minutes or so of him just maybe holding up somewhere?
So let's just assume he walks off. He doesn't spook at all. I've got the wind in my favor. I'm gonna play that turkey game. I'm gonna try to call and see if he's responsive, and get to where I can shoot to where he came from before. I may not bring the decoy with me because I don't want him to. I want him to be exactly what he did before if I can. And then if he gets there and I get a shot, great. But if he doesn't want to come back, he's kind of tried that. He's not interested anymore. Then I feel like I've got to move. I've got to circle based on the wind. If he's still vocal, man, that makes things so much more predictable because I can kind of keep track of him and get a line of where he's going. Hopefully I know the country around there, and I might have an idea of, okay, he's heading to that north facing slope to bed up for the day. I need to get close to that or in front of him going that way and use those terrain and my knowledge to do it. But a lot of times, especially on heavily pressured areas, over the counter especially, you know, you don't get that many bugles. You get some, so you end up playing a waiting game. In your scenario, we saw the bull, but if you don't see the bull and he quits calling, you don't know what you don't know what he's doing, so you have to take your best guess. And, you know, a lot of times I will ease through there with the decoy, trying to figure out where he's gone. If he won't, you know, I always say we didn't strike him again like you do with a turkey, but if he doesn't bugle back, you know, you're just kind of easing up through there and using your best guess. Do you have historical information? You know, have you hunted there before and messed with elk and they always seem to go this way? Those kind of things you have to plug into it. But if he's still bugling and going away, I'm keeping the wind in my favor and trying to get a loop on him, which is really easy to do in flat South Carolina and maybe Iowa, but sometimes up there you can't keep up. You know, when those things decide they're going, you're out of the game. Yeah. But I always want to try to call him back to where he was comfortable, because something about that, he was okay to get to that point. I have a chance of calling him back to that. That has happened before. That's not unheard of. So that's my highest odds.
Yeah.
Did he see the decoy too? You know, maybe I put it in the wrong place. That could be. So maybe I do move the decoy if I feel like he couldn't see it. But if I feel like he could see the decoy from where he came and I couldn't get a shot, there's some hesitancy that's holding him up there. Did he see me? Did he smell something he didn't like? There's always those dang thermal swirls and stuff up there too. So.
Yeah. You know, just like turkey, sometimes they're henned up and they'll gobble, but
and they won't come so far from that flock, right?
Right. So how do you then, what is your strategy when an elk is herded up with a whole bunch of cows? Maybe he's the main bull, right? He's the big dog. And he's the only bull. Maybe there's not a lot of there's no satellite bulls or anything in the area, or and you've found him, right? You found the herd bull. And how would you then use your decoy to pull him off of a real life cow? Is that possible?
I think you got to create. It's possible. It's tough though, man. It's tough to get those bulls away from their cows at that level. I think there are a lot of great elk hunters, certainly better than me, that's a conundrum they face every year. I think what you got to do is get as close as you can without spooking him or the cows, and you got to convince him that one of his cows is going rogue on him. She's trying to leave. She's, you know, and maybe you do some raking with a branch or a shed or something back in there to kind of paint that picture. If there's another bull here, I can hear that one. Maybe bugle some, a squeal. Mm-hmm. And here's a cow that's leaving because you're doing the cow calls. And if you could just get to that bubble again, well within that bubble again, and he could see the decoy, and in his mind, you've already convinced him there's a bull out there. That cow is going to that other bull. You got a good chance of him coming down trying to herd her back, you know, because they'll push those cows around like crazy. Otherwise, you're just trying to figure out a travel pattern and getting where you think they're going to go and getting close enough to get a shot without spooking them. And, you know, if you got the decoy up and the cows come to the decoy, you got a whole bunch of eyes around you. So sometimes in that scenario, I might keep that decoy in my pack if I'm just trying to slip up to them. You know, I don't want anything to engage them at all. I'm just relying on me being able to sneak close enough that he walks by for a shot at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then so, I use the decoy to take a nap on, I guess.
There you go. If it all goes wrong, it's just a little nap at higher elevation. Perfect. Yeah. Any final thoughts, as far as maybe strategy or tips on using a decoy for antelope or elk that you can think of that we have not discussed?
Again, I'm a decoy salesman for a living. So, our decoys just don't weigh enough to matter based on what you're doing, and you can put them behind your pack so you can easily deploy them. We make a backcountry elk that folds up so small, I shove it behind the arrows in my quiver sometimes. So the downside of carrying a decoy and not needing it is very small. You know, it's just a little bit of weight. You could clip them to bushes. You don't even have to take the leg pole if you really want to cut weight. It's just a small investment that may be that key tool for any part of the hunt you're doing, because you're going to find a scenario if you don't have it where you're like, nothing's going on, we're just going to sit here and do some blind calling. Having that decoy set up in that scenario is just something to kind of a CYA, because, you know, if you're sitting there and you're halfway dozing off and you've been calling for an hour and suddenly a stick cracks and you look over and there's a bull, it's a whole lot better if he's looking at a decoy instead of looking around all the time while you're trying to get your bow.
But,
you know, not being afraid to use them, doing that safely, you know, with other hunters around, in archery seasons as well as gun seasons, you need to think about safety. But there's just not really a reason to, in my opinion, you know, I was using them before I was involved with this company. So it's just not a reason to take it and have it as a tool in your toolkit, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a fact. And I will say this, one of the coolest experiences that I've ever been on, me and my buddy played paper, rock, scissors for who got the first shot at this elk that we went with my buddy Adam, me and my buddy Ryan. We played paper, rock, scissors on this elk, and my buddy won. So I went down the mountain and flanked him in case there was something happened and he bailed on us. My other buddy, Adam, he went down and he did exactly what you said. He started a war in this timber. He was throwing logs, he was taking sticks and smashing them on the tree, cow calling. Like, he basically just painted this picture of an elk raking a tree and another herd of cows coming through, right? And this elk was bedded, and we got close enough where we could see the tips of his antlers, and he was bedded, and he was bugling and responding. And then he had enough. He stood up and he came charging down. My buddy hit his shoulder and the arrow just kind of bounced off of him, which that was unfortunate.
Tough on those things.
Exactly. Long story short, but it was an amazing experience. And so I can see how hunting with a second person, with them falling back, that's a strategy that I do with turkey hunting and a decoy, is even move them back a little further and then call like they're going away and try to pull them in just a little bit. And the hunter stays in the same place, but the guy with the decoy and the calling drops back another 100, 200 yards or whatever the case is.
Yeah. And sometimes he can, you know, we make one now called the flasher for this reason, but you can show the decoy and then hide the decoy. And it's like, where did the elk go? He knows that bull knows he saw it, an elk. Mm-hmm. So he's actively looking. I feel like that makes him more inclined to come forward. You know, if he stops somewhere and he could totally see the elk decoy, hopefully he's in range. Maybe he's not. He's waiting on that cow to make the next move. But when that cow has disappeared, he doesn't know where she went. So he's more likely to keep looking. And I think going back to, like, why not have one? You know, you're walking all day. If you're doing an over-the-counter DIY hunt, you're putting in miles, you're putting in effort, you're sweating. You know, it's one more step you got to take, sure. But if you can get that to be part of your routine of, okay, we're going to set up here, let's put the decoy over here, you know, he just falls into laziness sometimes. If I'm going to set up, I'm going to call, and I'm not going to hear anything again, so I'm not going to waste the 5 seconds it takes me to put this decoy up. Be diligent, disciplined, put that thing up. It's not going to do you any good in your pack.
Exactly.
Unless it's nap time.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, my friend, I think we had a good conversation today. I really appreciate it. I myself am sitting on, I just bought yesterday my 11th antelope and elk hunt, or elk preference point for Wyoming, and my ninth, and my ninth Wyoming deer point. So I'm ready. I think I'm getting to the point now where I can go to a good unit. I don't know. Maybe I'm not.
Do you know where you're going yet? Don't spit out the unit. Just, do you know where you're going?
I know. Here's what I will say. I don't feel like I want to hunt in grizzly bear country. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. I get that.
You know what I mean? Especially if I'm going to be solo. I'm not experienced enough with that. Unless I'm going to be going with someone who is experienced, I would feel more comfortable doing that. So, man, CJ, thanks again for your time today, and good luck this upcoming season, man.
Same to you. And I appreciate you having me, man. I love doing this, because this I forgot we were doing a podcast. It just felt like we were chatting it up. So 100%. I enjoyed that. Thank you, buddy.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.